There
oh, the champagne.
The champagne to cheers toast to our first Friday.
I've got
all right.
Yes.
What, do we have Jared? Do we have to get a what is up partner up going in here?
I don't know how you can lead me in with such a lame way of presenting that. What is up, partner up? Let's go. No,
I just took it right out from under you.
I know. I just took the wind out of my sails, Isaac. But yeah, so we're doing a live episode of Partner Up here on First Friday. So it's a new thing that was Isaac's idea because he always has the best ideas, as much flack as I give him. So every First Friday, we're doing a virtual event here at Partner Hacker. Happy to be joined by our partners in crime, Keyflo and Felipe, who we just got to hear from. And Isaac, let's kick off this episode and tell the folks that are listening here. And you know, after the event, so we recorded this Friday, it'll be released you know, on a Tuesday, what we were just going through. Why were we all gathered here on this first Friday?
Yeah, you know, that I'm super excited about doing these, and I hope everybody just makes it a ritual. Just mark off the first Friday of every month. It's going to be 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern. Just mark it off. Join us for the block party. Join us with your drink. It's going to be really, really fun. picking up Isaac's dropped mic, Adam says in the chat. But for this very first Friday, we're super thrilled to have Keyflo join us. And it was really fun. And the topic was on, we called it sizes and everything, that you can have a huge impact as a small upstart partner program. And we just kind of talked through some great stories regarding that. Including Jared's at PandaDoc, when PandaDoc was, you know, very, very small, didn't even have an API, as you told us, you know, won the partnership with HubSpot. So that's kind of been the theme. And I have a, hold on.
I'm actually going to tee this one up really well. So I get to turn the tables now because Isaac always has the best ideas. I'm just a talking head. I just gave my story of, you know, partnering up and winning. And then the Partner Hacker Handbook, by the time this is live, if y'all haven't picked up a copy, it's free, digital, like just give it out. We're not charging anything for it. If you want a physical copy, we're selling them at cost, literally what Amazon literally prints them for. So like we're making $0 off this. I got to tell my story of like how to win alliances, like how small programs can win with big partners. Isaac, I think you have a failure story.
I do, man. I think I
want to start with that one.
Yeah, as you and Kevin were talking about how you went through and won this white whale, I was like, you know, I did something real similar a couple of years back, and it didn't work out. And I was kind of trying to like dissect. So with a previous company, it was basically a platform for job seekers. So a little bit different than B2B. But I saw this opportunity. I connected with somebody over at Chegg. I've never told this story before anywhere, by the way. I connected with somebody at Chegg, which started out as like a textbook rental company, but now they're much, much more. They're publicly traded. They're, you know, it's like a subscription service for college students to get like test prep, you know, textbooks, all kinds of stuff. And I went into this thinking, okay, we're like literally brand new startup with like a couple hundred users a month, you know, getting on our platform to use our tools to find jobs. But I got this connection that I had kind of figured my way into. And I thought, okay, I got to learn and understand, is there anything that they care about that we could help with in any possible way? And I didn't know the lingo at the time. I didn't know anything about this, you know, partnership stuff that, you know, in a formal sense, but I was trying to get to that black swan. And so in the course of the conversation, I'm like, okay, first thing I need to understand is I got to understand their business model. So I'm like, all right, where's your revenue coming from? Let me understand your business model. Let me get underneath the hood there. And basically I figured out, it wasn't that complicated. It's like a like $20 a month subscription. And they are basically when students are nearing the end of university, they cancel their subscription because they don't need test prep anymore, whatever. But they have something like, I'm making these numbers up because I don't remember, but it's like a couple million, like 3 million $20 a month subscribers, something like that. So for them, each additional like average week of retention is worth like $15 million to them, right? So every additional unit of time they can keep their average user subscribed is very, very valuable. And so I thought, students transitioning out of college, what do? They go on the job market. If I go to them and say, hey, we'll offer you this job hunting tool for free, you put it on there and it comes with your Chegg subscription, we're going to get tons and tons and tons of users. And for every, if it only makes them stay on for an extra couple days or couple weeks, you're going to generate millions of value, right? And we'll get all this massive distribution. So I kind of gathered this intel on the call, and it was a very like real casual laid back call where I was able to get like all kinds of really interesting information. And then after the call, I sort of followed up with this pitch, and it never went anywhere. I couldn't get any follow-ups. I couldn't get anything to happen. And I thought, man, this is like such a brilliant move here. I thought I had figured out something brilliant. And so I tried to figure out why. And I think there's a couple reasons that I can think of off the top of my head. One, I think, is we needed a way to better demonstrate that we could actually fulfill this. So instead of pitching him immediately, like I'm a very jump the gun type of person, I immediately sent an email like the next day or even sooner. Hey, here's your issue. You want to get people to stay on longer. We have this tool. It's been effective for our users to help them find jobs, blah, blah, blah. You know, here's whatever, like you join it, you put it on your platform. You're going to, I didn't have any proof that it was helping his users. Like I should have hacked together some kind of way, maybe run some targeted ads at Chegg users somehow, or somehow tap into and say, hey, look, we did a 2-week experiment and here's what we found, like without waiting for permission. It's a publicly traded company, so it's hard to navigate. It's, you know, we were like a 5-person, 6-person startup. So I think I should have had some more proof points. That was problem failure number one. And I just didn't, I just pitched him cold, like it's going to work without any proof. And I think the second problem is I was talking to the wrong person. This guy was awesome. He was very forthcoming. He was very sympathetic to me because he was a founder who had been acquired by Chegg, but that was the problem. He was rest invest. He was there for his obligatory 2 years and he was going to go start another company. And he was just like waiting and he didn't care that much. He just wasn't that. And I figured this out on the call, but so what I should have done was be more patient, take this tidbit of knowledge I had about the value of every additional week somebody stays on after they graduate college, and go and try to put some proof points together, go and research and find who is the right person at Chegg. It would have taken me a lot longer. It would have taken a lot of sleuthing, a lot. And I'm like really impatient, action-oriented guy. I'm like, I'm going to just shoot my shot now. And then they passed. And I did like my obligatory like 10 follow-up emails over the next month. And it died. So I feel like there was something there.
I'm gonna chime in there, and then I'm gonna kick it to Felipe on so he can talk trash on how bad you screwed this up.
I've got questions. I just want to learn more.
So I'll go back to what Jill Rowley said at Ecosystem Week. So I'm wearing my Ecosystem Week shirt, which that was fun. It's the limited edition. I don't think anyone's any seen these. There's only like 20 of them in existence. Prove you care. Prove you care. What proof was there? There was your words. There was your emails, maybe albeit eloquently written, Mr. Copy Father, Isaac Morehouse. you know how to frame an idea as good as anyone, but how did you prove you cared? And the reality is like, shit, that's the difference, right? Yep. Like when you write and we write about giving first and all that stuff, that's awesome. It's great. But you got to prove it. And actions speak far louder than words. And I think that's the difference between like why the PandaDoc story worked is like, we were just in action mode on like, we assumed that the partnership was done. Like, oh, the partnership, we're just going to go do all the stuff that we were going to do otherwise. Like, I don't need to sell them on anything. And then the sale's going to happen. Right. So I don't know, Felipe,
because I didn't prove that I was invested in making this happen. It's like when someone applies for a job and they're like, hey, if you hire me, I'll do all this great stuff. Perfect. And you're like, maybe, but how much more impactful is, hey, I went ahead and did all this stuff for you. This is one of the reasons you should hire me, right? Like I went ahead and I made a 30-day plan that's really in depth. You know, I did this, I did that. Like, I think there's, I don't know. I think there's a lot there in just doing more than making a pitch, because you're not just competing against whatever they don't have now. You're competing against all the other companies who could try to make the same pitch.
Perfect. Putting you on the spot, Isaac. Okay, really quickly. Now that we're in 2022, how would you have played it different? What would you have done right now? to make it successful?
Now that I've learned every, yeah.
Because I'm sure a lot of people want to hear, how would you have made it successful now? How would you have done it now if that opportunity presented itself right now?
Now that Jared has partner pilled me so much, and I've learned a lot just from everybody in this partnership space, right? Like I was attempting to do partnership stuff as a CEO of a couple companies without understanding like what it was. And because there's really not much of a playbook for this stuff. I think here's a couple things I would do. I think first I would recognize his point of view more clearly and just remember, okay, they're aware of this issue, right? They are highly motivated to figure out ways to keep their people subscribed longer and to keep them on even post-graduation or in those final semesters. They're also aware of potential partners they could join up with who could provide complementary services to do this. And what's one of the main services? It's going to be in the job seeking and job hunting area. This is not going to be something that nobody there has ever thought of, right? So if I think of it that way, who might I be competing with and what might they be able to bring to the table versus me? And if it's just me saying, hey, you want to keep people on longer? We have a product that is good for job seekers. So there you go. Like, they're going to have other people coming to them. They're probably going to have freaking Indeed.com or whatever, right? Coming to them, big players. What can I bring that's more than just my word? So I would start by just recognizing that if that's going to be my pitch, don't even make it. Like, don't waste their time, right? Two, don't make the pitch after one phone call with one guy. There was a great phone call and we really hit it off, but don't make the pitch. Like, he even was like, hey, well, if you want to get acquired, they're always hiring. We could do an aqua hire, right? I was it's like, it was just kind of like lazy, like, eh, Chegg is hiring. You seem like a smart guy in the career space, right? Like,
we'll pay you 150 grand a year to come work here.
right, exactly. Like, so I think I would have taken some time, would have taken that tidbit, and I would have been like, told my team, I'm going on like a 2-week deep dive. Mm-hmm. Like, leave me alone. I'm committed to figuring out how to make it work with Chegg. Cause if we make it work with Chegg, we instantly are on the map. We're instantly a legit deal. Mm-hmm. So I'm going all in on this. I'm going to research everything I can. I'm going to find every person I can connect with there. Who is the ideal person whose salary depends on changing that metric? And it wasn't this guy.
The person.
Yeah. Whose paycheck is going to be, you know, increased or decreased based on that metric? Can I find who that is? Can I connect with them? Can I build rapport? I had a career podcast. We had one with the company. I would do that all the time. Bring people on the podcast, interview them as a guest. Hey, you're working at Chegg. I want to get your insights. Let's come on the podcast. Right. And I'd have great conversations and then figure out from there, how can I connect further, build it over time. And then, so that's one, like, really invest in them as if I'm going to do this, whether they officially sign off or not. I'm going to do something with Chegg. And then number two, can we find a way to test? Can we do a test that doesn't require anyone's permission from Chegg? Can we go scrap together some subset of their audience? Can we go find, we had connections to different, you know, students, universities. Hey, anybody who's ever used Chegg before, you know, let's put together, maybe we do a survey, maybe we do some sort of beta test, maybe we put together a lookalike audience from Chegg users and we run something and we say, these people used our platform for X number of weeks and got this kind of results, right? Like, is there something that I can quantify it with after investing with the right person? So that's how I would think about it now. And I would treat it much, much more seriously than like, oh, this is a brilliant pitch. I should just make the pitch right now, you know? Right.
Yeah, I think the same way, along the same lines as you. I would have literally gone on LinkedIn, looked at the connections, the second, third, whatever, connected with everyone they know, and try to get another angle in. You know, because you got to think about partnerships as networking. Also, you've got to kind of come in from different angle, influence other people so that they can get you that white whale, as we call it. So Shawnee did say, why not just give up? I think giving up is easy, especially when it's such a big opportunity. So essentially,
that's a good question, though. Yeah, Jared, I'd like to hear your take on this too. When do you give up? Because I mentioned in the chat before that I was recently talking with somebody and was like, "Who at your company's salary depends on this metric?" And yeah. It was something that we could impact, and they said nobody. And then I was like, "Okay, forget it. I don't want to waste my time on this person because the thing we can help them with, they don't even care about as a company. It's not going to, when do you know that it's like, don't put any more energy in it? Like, cause some white whales are not worth going after. How do you make that call?
I'm responding to Adam in the chat is, you know, so he said,
as an ex sales guy, until you don't get a no, it's not over. That's my take.
Yeah. You know, so no's are, they're deceitful. Like I've heard the phrase, a no is not a no until it's a no from the CEO. Isaac, you've personally seen me take no's from the CEO and turn them into yeses. I've talked previously about, you know, having conviction and being passionate. I don't give a shit what anyone thinks about me, but I can, they can never deny whether or not I care. Meaning, when do you give up? You never give up. But you better make damn sure that you're never giving up on the right things. That means making better choices. So trying to figure out partnerships and not having the conviction that you're willing to die on that hill, guess what? If I'm willing to die on that hill, I'm always going to win. You don't have a chance because I care more than you. I'm invested more than you. I'm going to do the research. I'm going to put in the work to where nobody can beat me. So if you're asking the question, when do you give up? That means that you do not have the choice figured out. You haven't made your decision on where you're going to play and how you're going to win. And I think the difference between the winners and the losers, the builders, the geniuses, and then the professionals, is that they have made a choice. And that choice is intentional. And they've gone and so far as to say that this is a strategic imperative. And I'm going to win no matter what. And guess what? There's 10,000 MarTech companies, right? There's going to be a million tech companies by the end of the decade. There's this podcast. There's this event. There's going to be people out there that are going to go, I'm going to die on this hill. Don't play the alliances game unless you're willing to die on the hill. Because you might find someone like me that's willing to die on that hill. That's my advice. Is like, when do you give up? Giving up shouldn't be an option. It's called the strategic imperative for a reason. A strategic imperative follows a strategic problem. Meaning, if we do not do this, we do not win. Shit, then that means we have to do it. Meaning, when do you give up? It's like, that means death. That means failure. So that's my very animated way of responding to that.
That certainly makes identifying the ICP or, you know, the ideal partner really important. Right. I mean, because if you're not going to give up, you better have a target that makes sense, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you have to have the conviction. Like, whenever I'm engaged in a sales conversation, it's because I care about that conversation more than anyone in the world. I mean, that, to me, that's not a sales conversation. I'm just showing up being like, I care as much as you, more than you. And I feel like for alliances to work, how small programs can win big partners, you have to recognize that if they're a big partner, they don't give a shit about you. If you're a 20-person startup, a 40-person, a 50-person, 100-person, 200, 500, 1,000, and you're working with a multi-thousand person org, they're not showing up with the same level of care about that conversation that you are. Not even close, by the very nature of just size. So what makes you so confident that you can convince someone bigger than you? If you can't answer that question.
Philippe, I'm curious, because you have a sales background as well as the partnership stuff. When you get on that call where there's that asymmetrical level of care, right? You care way more about the outcome of this call than the other person. What do you do right off the bat to get them engaged, to get them to that level?
Wow. That's a tough question, you know. It's, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, you have to come to grips with the fact that big companies care less, and it's unfortunate that they care less and they just want to do their time and go home and drink beers. So we're not.
Wait a minute. There's nothing wrong with going home and drinking a beer or a whiskey.
For those just tuning in on audio, we are at First Friday, folks, and we do have a
Hydration is king. Hydration is king. But essentially, yeah, the moment you come on a call and the other person, you know, is just there because they need to, for example, get a PRM and they're not interested and they just want to kind of see what you're doing. For me, it's already kind of dying. That's why for me, a no is, it's easier to say no because there's so much opportunity out there. So it's better to not waste your time on something that you know and you're not 100% confident in because there's so much out there. So coming back to your point, Isaac, I think if you nail down your ICP, IPP, you can really optimize your time on not wasting it on the wrong people and the wrong places. Okay.
Yeah.
And it always comes back to that, focusing on who the ideal profile is. And then you can essentially just Jared's mentality, I'm going to die until I get them in my, for example, partner program. I'm going to do everything I can. I'm going to die on top of that hill. But essentially, if you don't get the ICP right, I think you can just spend days trying to nail down things that will never kind of come your way. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, and I think sometimes, sometimes this doesn't always isn't always the right approach. Being really, really blunt up front, like, okay, I want to know, like literally opening a call with, I want to know who in your company's salary or compensation, you know, is impacted by X metric. Like sometimes that doesn't work. Sometimes it comes, but sometimes it's actually refreshing. If the person on the other side of the call is like, all right, I'm showing up to this call. It's not that important to me whether it goes well or whatever comes of it, but I'm doing it. And you're showing up like this is a big deal. Mm-hmm. Like almost shocking them out of that complacency from the get-go can sometimes be really effective. I know I've seen Jared use that tactic before.
So you just ask them, can you send me towards someone who's more interested than you? Is that what
you mean? Not even necessarily ask them to send you to someone else, but to be like, okay, what would it take to make this be interesting? What would it take to make this call matter to you? Or what would it take to make my company matter to you? Right. Or like,
what would it take for this to be a no brainer? Right. Like what would it take for this to be something that this is more exciting than anything else you have going on?
Hmm. Yes. Yes.
And there's those, you know, like cascading kind of effects.
That's how you tease out. That's how you tease out that black swan info, by the way. If you can't find it externally, it's like, all right, what would it take to make us so interesting to you, right? That you would be willing to drop X, Y, and Z, right? What would make this the most exciting thing? And then they'll start to tell you. And oftentimes they'll start off with a, oh, you're not going to like the answer because you don't stand a chance. Look, here's what we're looking at. This is how much money we make. This is how much you know, you're not going to make a dent. And then you keep teasing at that. You don't take that for an answer, right? You don't say, you're right, we're really small, I guess it doesn't matter. You're like, no, hold on a second, right?
Will's correct. Ask the hot questions.
I have to interrupt here because you have to make sure that who you're asking that question with is the right person. You don't get a shot to ask that question to the executive, right? You don't get to ask the question, what would make this the most important thing in the world to you? It's like, don't you value my time? I thought you had the answer for that for me, right? So that's a great thing to do with the coaches is what I call them. They're not champions. They're willing to give you information downstream. Yes. You ask those questions. What would make this the most important thing in the world for you, for your boss, for your company? And then here's the difference between the people that get these deals done and the people that don't. The people that get these deals done, these big alliances, they show up to that executive meeting with, I'm about to blow your mind. I mean, I've said the same thing 3 times in a row, and I've become 0 to #1 alliance partner 3 times in a row by saying this thing. You don't know me yet, but in less than 1 year, I'm going to be your #1 partner globally, and you're going to try to buy me. Here's exactly why. And I am so confident in that pitch because I have the answers to the test. That's my advice.
We got to zoom out for a second, though, because you dropped something. You were saying it in the chat when I was telling my story about how I flubbed up 6 ways from Sunday. You said something about a coach, and I didn't know what you meant. Now I get it. You creating these categories of different types of context at these companies in your head, that's really, really key. So like immediately on the call, you might be able to identify, got it. This person is a coach. This is someone, they're not going to put themselves on the line and put in a whole bunch of social capital and go champion for me. They're also not a decision maker who can make the deal happen, but they are totally willing, for whatever reason, personal rapport, strategically, whatever, they're willing to give me information and just talk. And those people are great, but you can't mistake them. See, I think that's what I mistook a coach for a decision maker or somebody that I should be pitching. And
typically not a decision maker, but a coach and a champion are two very different things. A champion is someone that's going to drive the next step, right? A coach is someone that's going to give you information, right?
Yep. Yeah. See, this is the thing, Jared, all this stuff, everybody in the chat's like, oh yeah, this is sales 101, coach, blocker, influencer. I have never done any, I've never learned anything the right way. I've always gone and done everything and completely failed at it. And then like figured out through trial and error. And then later someone's like, oh, you never read the book that just told you how to do it. I'm like, oh, there was a book.
But yeah. You're the bookmaster too. I mean,
the wrong kinds of books, I guess.
Yeah, no. You've read more books than everyone on this call. I know you have. Felipe, I want to turn the conversation back towards you, and like, because I feel like Keyflow, you get exposed to a lot of like SMB programs, right? And we're kind of talking about how small programs can win big results. And I've certainly overemphasized and covered the alliances side of like our first Friday event. I'd love to hear more from you and the team kind of around where you're seeing SMBs partnering together at the same size, right? So a small program with many other partners that maybe are other smaller partners. Like I just get laid out an alliance strategy, which is very different. This is going all in and winning at all costs because there's seven figures or multiples of seven figures. I mean, $1 million deal, a $6 million deal, $30 million in revenue. That's what I'm talking about. It shifts market. It changes categories. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't have an ecosystem of small partners. I'm just not great at that. So I'd love to hear what you've kind of heard on like how a small program might be able to work with other small partners successfully. What have you guys seen?
Oh, I've seen so many things, but I do want to say off the bat, we do have customers with small programs, but they have huge partners like KPMG, right. Ernst & Young. And it's crazy. And then they come on calls and they're like, oh, we have this partner, you know, they're doing this. But essentially, if we focus on the small partners, you know, one of the biggest ones we've seen is obviously the tech partners. Okay. People essentially have their API and they want to integrate to other systems. Okay. And essentially, we've also seen a lot of our, you know, our customers partnering with a lot of solution providers. So, you know, SMBs, they have this product, but they don't have the manpower to onboard the customer they get from their sales team. Okay. Because SMBs, you've got to know they've got small team, they've got limited bandwidth. They can't spend enormous amount of times with each customer. So this is where, for me, I think SMBs and programs, I've seen our customers really focus on solution providers because they have a great product. They've spent so many years developing it, but they only have a team of 10 to 50 people. Okay, that's quite small. And essentially, what they do is they partner with solution providers, and these partners essentially help their customers adopt the software they have built. They essentially train their partners on how they should onboard customers, how to answer the support requests, all these things. And essentially, these partners are really small. You know, these solution partners are just like consultancy agencies that essentially just want to help customers set up a software. For example, if you go to HubSpot, you've got this page called the solution providers or the marketplace, and you can see all the consultants that help set up HubSpot. And it's exactly the same, you know, with our customers. They have a set list of partners that they give to their customers, and the customers essentially contact them. And essentially, there's a great kind of synergy between our customers and the partners where, you know, the our customer gives our partner all the tools and tips necessary in order for their customers to succeed through the partner. Okay. So the partner essentially is an extension of their company for SMBs. Does that make sense, Jared?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, there's this old advice, and I feel like I'm rebelling more and more against this old advice on like from the smart people that know how to build partnerships and channels. Screw that. They don't. The VCs that you're talking to, they're getting religion now, but they don't know how to do this. They're like, hey, you need to build the perfect franchise model before you go try and build other McDonald's, right? The kitchen needs to be perfect. The French fries, the presentation, all of this stuff. that used to be good advice. It is no longer good advice. It's garbage advice. Mm-hmm. Perfect the franchise before you go partner. F that, right? So if you're a small program, you're a small company, and you see a couple agencies, like you have, I don't even care if you have dozens of customers, not hundreds, dozens. And you see a couple agencies or service providers raising their hands, and they're getting as good as the product as anyone at your company. Guess what? You know what your CSMs can't do? I told this story at Drift a lot. I was like, how many of our CSMs have ever been chief marketing officers? Zero. Like, what are you talking about? We need to control the customer experience. None of our customers have been CMOs. I have two fucking CMOs right here of marketing agencies trying to help our customers. And you think someone 2 years out of college that has never managed millions of dollars in marketing spend is going to go help our customers more than this entry-level person? Mm-hmm. Guess what? They're like, okay, yeah, you might be right about that. So in the early stages, when you're like, no, we need to control the customer experience. We need to do this. We need to own that. If you have partners that are better at you than something, don't feel like, well, we got to figure our stuff out first. No, just focus on figuring it out for them. Like, why do you think that you need to build enablement, hiring, a program, a flywheel, a model, and then, okay, then I can go teach a partner. What if you just skip to, well, what if we just focus on teaching the partner?
Correct.
What's so bad about that? There's nothing that bad about that.
And Jared, I just want to add, you know, like the SMB market, like PRMs didn't exist for SMBs before, you know, SMBs couldn't afford PRMs. And that's why essentially people didn't want a partner because it was so hard to manage them. It was impossible. But now we've got these tools that can help you manage these small to medium businesses and these partners that these companies partner with. And essentially, in my view, is I think SMBs will be the main kind of business for partners. Okay, SMBs are the ones that are going to be partnering the most, in my opinion, because these are the companies that need those, you know, multiple years of experience of these agencies, consultants, and these are going to be the real partners going forward.
Let me tell you two stories in response to that that will throw every traditional or conventional, you know, piece of wisdom around when to bring partners into your company out the window. Mm-hmm. Do you know the answer to who HubSpot's number one partner globally was? What was their company prior to becoming a HubSpot agency? Do you know the answer to that question, Felipe?
Nope. Isaac knows. Come on, Isaac.
I think I do because you told me before, Jared, but I won't give it away.
It was a pool cleaning company. They cleaned pools. And you're like, what? Yeah, Paul Reutzer. Now he's the CEO of the AI Marketing Institute. Yeah, kind of big jump and leap from like cleaning pools to being CEO of the AI Marketing Institute. Why is that so important? Paul was a customer of HubSpot. Mm-hmm. And he went, hey, this content thing kind of works. Like I can kind of like dominate SEO and like get Google results and like kind of own things. And I can franchise my pool company based on owning search and, you know, areas like pool cleaning services in, you know, X city. And this is really early. But so he started franchising his business. Guess how good, I mean, Paul's an entrepreneur. He's a smart dude, right? Like he had to manage a P&L of a pool services company. That's real world. That's not like venture backed startup. That means like you have payroll to make, like you have to be profitable.
Hey now, day one. Shots fired.
Right. Like that's real world stuff. Like you have a service to provide, you know, have you ever been in a pool cleaning company? You screw up someone's pool and they're rich and they have a pool. They fire you so fast. Right. Like their tolerance for their pool being perfect or not perfect is like nothing. So he figured out how to do HubSpot as good as anyone. And then he started selling services. And then he became like HubSpot's most essential partner. Now tell him, what about that scenario is a playbook driven? Oh yeah. Like pool services companies make great agency resellers. Like there's no playbook for that.
But there's an insight
well,
in there.
I'll tell you another one. Guess what was Drift's?
Okay. Yeah, go
what
ahead.
Was Drift's?
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say the insight in there is just so key because it's who, you know, people will say this, who is the best salesperson for your product? Your customers. But that's very real and more than just the like NPS score, like, oh, well, they say nice things about you or refer a friend. If we say, hey, you get a bonus if you refer a friend. That pattern with the pool company is actually very, very real. Like, I have many, many examples of people in my own life, and even to a degree, some of the things I've been involved in where you go start a company doing something, and what you started, you maybe don't succeed at all. Like, he succeeded at his pool company, but maybe you don't succeed, but you find that you were like sneakily, surprisingly good at one element of the business that other people running other businesses aren't good at. And you go start selling that to them. Like, I've seen that pattern happen many, many times where you go to start a business, you're not good at it, but you were incredible at, let's say, the content component, or you were incredible at, you know, the way you ran your back office. I mean, this is my brother's story. So then he started selling back office services to other businesses. And so like that idea of, you know, looking at your customer as more than just who they are today, looking at your customer of who they may be tomorrow.
Right.
Huge insight.
Yeah. I mean, the second example I had was, what was Drift's number one partner globally? What was their business prior to being a Drift marketing agency?
A hot air balloon company. I can't make this shit up.
Now you're making it up. Now you're making it up.
Eliav Cohen, right? Seattle Ballooning. And you go look at his company, Ultra Cool Bots. And he's like one of the top Drift. He's like the master of bots. But see, Eliav was retired in hot air ballooning. He was actually a sales director for a medical healthcare technology company. And like, he knew sales really well. He knew marketing really well. And, you know, the ballooning company was kind of his retirement. And then he got addicted to the bots that were automatically booking meetings for his ballooning company. And he's like, I'm going to go sell this to all the ballooning companies in the world. And then he's like, wait, I can sell this to everyone. And the next thing you know, he's closing $50,000, $100,000 retainers on building Drift bots for the world. And this is a sophisticated, you know, 25-year plus entrepreneur, heads up against my CSMs, that's had the ownership of the outcome of the tech being implemented.
Drifting away into the clouds. There's got to be a lot of good puns we can.
Yeah. No, literally in the Drift headquarters, there's a picture of like Eliav drifting in a balloon, hot air balloon, and doing Drift conversations. Like, it's a giant blown up picture, right? He used to record videos like, hey, I'm answering sales calls in my hot air balloon today, you know, like using Drift. But I think that's the point, you know, tie this back to Felipe, your question around all of this is like, it doesn't mean that you even have to have, you know, KPMG or Accenture in your program. What it means is that you need to have a commitment to partners from day one, how small programs can win big results. Like, if you see, it almost goes back to the gardening platforms conversation, Isaac, like when you start to see those seeds like pop up when you weren't expecting them, like pay attention, get close.
Yeah.
Because there's no way you could have told me those two examples when I knew nothing about partnerships. HubSpot's number one partner globally is going to be a pool services company. Hey, Jared, when you go to Drift, your number one partner is going to have a hot air balloon company. I've been like, you're full of hot air. Yeah.
No, I mean, no way. And when anyone has any amount of success, especially like if you notice it, or especially if they come to you and say, hey, this is really working for me. Like, no matter how small they seem at the time, that's where you like show love, shower love on them, right? Because they could turn out to be the white whale, right? Maybe you don't have to catch the white whale. You can grow them in your fish tank, you know.
There you go.
I wanted before we end, we got a few minutes. I wanted to tie back to the first session with Will and Adam and Ben about going from zero to one. I thought it was really interesting because it was almost like a mirror of the second session, how to get a white whale. All the tactics you guys talked about with going and winning that partner, establishing rapport, finding the right person, showing that you care, developing, understanding the metrics that matter to them, showing that you can prove to those. It was almost like the mirror version of that in that zero to one about internally. That's what you got to do as a partner person with your own team. Figure out who in every department, like what are they accountable for? What are they going to have to be reporting for? What impacts their salary, right? Figuring out those things and figuring out how you can help them. It's like, that's what's crazy about this partnership's role is that you have these two audiences, that you have these mirror tactics and approaches that you have to use. I just thought that was a really interesting takeaway from that. I think it was Ben that said, it was Adam who said, shout out Adam, who said like every department has a partnership play. And so you got to go learn and understand, you know, what is motivating to those people? What are their incentives and getting to that and figuring out as quickly as possible how you can help that. And then you win them in. So I just wanted to connect that because I think that's really interesting, the symmetry between external and internal audiences.
Before we end, I do have a takeaway, you know, after hearing everyone's conversations and everyone's inputs. You know, our title is How Small Partners Win Big, How Small Programs Win Big Partners. But for me, essentially, the essence of this whole journey we've had together for the last 2 hours is how small programs win valuable partners. Because it doesn't matter how big your partner is. It doesn't matter if it's, you know, Ernst & Young. It doesn't matter. It's the value they bring you and how valuable they can be. Even if it's a pool cleaner, drift balloon company, it doesn't matter. It's the value of that partner that matters. And that's how you will kind of succeed in partnerships, in my opinion.
I love it. I love it. Thanks, everybody, for hanging out with us on First Friday. And Partner Woo-hoo! Up Crew, thanks for listening from afar on the feeds, the YouTubes, the Spotifys, and the Apples, where we actually dominate.
Yeah, join future First Fridays. You get to say you were here for the first one. If you're here today,
join Keyflow's webinar.
Yeah, Keyflow making it happen. Thank you so much. We're gonna hand it off to Shawnee. She's gonna bring us home. So,
all right, partner up. Peace out. We'll see you all next time.
Thank you all. Bye.